It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll look at efforts to improve child wellness in the United States.
First, according to media reports out today, Hillary Clinton will launch her presidential campaign this Sunday, putting to rest years of speculation about her presidential ambitions.
Aides confirmed that Clinton plans to announce that bid for the 2016 Democratic nomination for president online, and then a fundraising campaign kicks off. With us now is David Friedlander. He's senior political correspondent for The Daily Beast. David, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
So it's been a question, I think, for most people of not if, but when. So now we know the when. Why this weekend? Why now?
Well, you know, I think that's a very good question. I think there's sort of a little bit of a restlessness out there among Democrats in nearly primary states. I think there's a need, Democrats nationally see a need for her to sort of get ready and answer some of these attacks that are coming her way by the Republicans. But, you know, lastly, I think that they're just sort of ready. I mean, once everything's in place and you have everybody you need and you're sort of ready to open the door, why delay?
Is there an advantage to holding off sometimes? The fundraising works differently. In some cases, you're not drawing the attacks. As you say, Hillary Clinton, she's going to get the attacks whenever she starts. Any advantages to waiting longer than this?
I mean, I'm sure there are, but you know, they've waited long enough. And you know, if you can imagine the sort of 2008 campaign began in January 2007 when both Obama and Hillary announced. Now it's April, and you know she's been sort of losing altitude. I mean, a slew of polls came out this week that showed her actually losing to some not even top Republicans, but kind of middling Republicans like Rand Paul and Mike Huckabee.
And we've seen some of those Republicans, just two major ones so far, Rand Paul, as you mentioned, now the latest to officially kick off their campaigns. Is the timing now maybe going to help draw the attention back to the Democratic side that the Republicans otherwise will get as this steady stream continues?
I mean, you know, there really isn't a Democratic side. I mean, that's the sort of odd thing here. I mean, Hillary is a favorite for a non-incumbent like we've never seen this time around. So, you know, I think that, you know, we'll sort of see the cameras switch to her for certainly for a little while, but it's in the Democratic Party, it's really her and her alone.
Now, usually when you think of that big announcement, there's a room, a convention hall, there's balloons, there's screaming people. She's doing this online, it sounds like, on Sunday.
Yeah, I mean, as best we can tell. I mean, they're in an interesting situation where there's really no real competition for the primary for them at this point. And at the same time, there's this hungry media that has grown over the years that's now, you know, a thousand digital outlets have bloomed. And so I think they're trying to kind of avoid all that. I mean, it would be impossible to run a quote-unquote normal campaign considering all the attention she'll get, all of the media that's now devoted to covering her. So they're trying to sort of seemingly bypass all of that, just do an announcement online, go right out to Iowa, go to New Hampshire, meet with voters one-on-one, and you know, avoid all the Klieg lights for a little bit.
And she's been getting media attention anyway from reporters wondering if she's going to give a signal of that she's going to run, right? I mean, but it's like tea leaf reading instead of actual campaign coverage.
No, I mean, it's like been a campaign without a candidate for as long as anybody could stand.
And you said, you wrote in an earlier piece that she was a pretty good non-candidate. She was doing a pretty good job of non-candidacy for a while there.
Yeah, I mean, you know, they built a real infrastructure. You know, without her doing so much to it, I mean, but the people around her, there's this Ready for Hillary group that's been doing grassroots. There's a fundraising apparatus. I mean, she is going to walk into a Rolls Royce of a campaign operation.
Talking to David Friedlander of The Daily Beast, Hillary Clinton looks like is going to announce officially her candidacy for president this weekend. David, you mentioned there isn't really a Democratic side. There's Hillary Clinton. You know, back last time she ran, there was, of course, Barack Obama. John Edwards had a serious campaign for a while there. Is there still any thought that there's going to be a serious challenge in the Democratic primary to Hillary Clinton?
You know, I guess it depends on what you mean by serious. I mean, there are candidates out there. The former governor of Maryland, Martin O'Malley, is running, or just about running. The senator from Vermont, Bernie Sanders, seems to be running. Former Senator Jim Webb seems to be running. The former governor and senator of Rhode Island, Lincoln Chafee, announced that he's looking at running. But boy, I mean, these guys have a very, very small chance of derailing her. I don't doubt that at some point one of them will have a moment and one of them will, you know, spring up in the polls and it'll look sort of close for a while. But it's really a unique situation on the Democratic side.
Yeah, Lincoln Chafee running as a Democrat, apparently he was a Republican, as I recall, until, what, 2 years ago. What's I don't know if you've been following his announcement. Why is he running on the Democratic side?
Well, you know, if you remember now, he was a Republican for many years, a sort of Rockefeller, Northeastern, my Republican, ended up switching to an independent who caucused with the Democrats, turning against George Bush in the Iraq War, then ended up running for governor of Rhode Island, actually, leaving the Senate entirely, and was there really, I think, just for one term, left office, very unpopular. Certainly, I don't think anybody thought that Lincoln Chafee would be throwing his hat into the ring. But, if there's no one else to do it, you may as well, right?
And there's a hope from the, the progressive, the left, whatever you want to call it, wing of the Democratic Party that they can have some kind of standard bearer, even if they don't have a chance, to try to draw the conversation and to draw the candidate, Hillary Clinton, to their views on a variety of issues, trade, a lot of other things. Do you see that happening at all?
Yeah, I think they would like to. And what they're running up against, and this is a growing, vocal, energized part of the party that got behind Elizabeth Warren in Massachusetts, that helped elect Bill de Blasio, mayor of New York. But the problem is they also are aware that they don't have a candidate. So they seem to be trying to kind of generate energy and generate a campaign without a candidate.
And they're trying, now back to the Hillary Clinton campaign, they're trying to generate money in this next week. And in a piece you wrote about this, you're hearing that they're going to really try to raise a lot of money just in this next 1 week after she announces.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's going to be, I think as I wrote, I mean, I think they're going to raise more money in this, coming days than any Democrat has raised any time since then. And I think they just want to swamp the rest of the Democratic Party. And, it's worth noting here that they are just raising money for the primary campaign. They want to try to show to voters that they're very committed to, running hard in the primary and winning every state and winning every vote. And so they're not raising any general election money for now.
Really? So then they have to raise a whole another ton of money, assuming that Hillary Clinton wins the nomination, for the general election then?
They will be. The money's sort of funny these days, because with all these super PACs and everything else, there are these venues where the candidate may not even need to do a lot of fundraising herself or himself. The money can sort of, huge checks can go to these, entities that are associated with the candidate. At some point, I'm sure she'll start raising for the general before the primary ends. But for now, they're saying they're just focusing on primary dollars.
Now, speaking of the primary, these other Democrats you mentioned who may not have high hopes, how do you see them maybe attacking Hillary Clinton's record? Do you see an aggressive campaign for them?
Well, I mean, what's been remarkable is that they're in the sort of pre-campaign we've had so far, they haven't been attacking her at all. And sometimes they sound like they're all just trying to angling for jobs in her cabinet or with her administration. They've really refrained from criticizing her record. Not that there aren't things there for them to criticize, but they're not doing it. I mean, I think that they're trying to sort of realize that they don't want to, be hitting her from the inside, so to speak.
Well, on the other side of the coin, there are lots of people more than willing to attack Hillary Clinton's record on the Republican side. Does her official announcement change anything that they're doing or saying, this growing list of candidates?
Well, that's a good question. Probably not much. I mean, they've all assumed she's running. They've all assumed she's a nominee. They've been training their fire on her, for a long time, and I'm sure that'll continue. It may sort of increase in volume for a moment, but they also need to work on, figure out each other's weaknesses and try to exploit them. So their focus is there for a while. I would imagine you'll see more and more people jump into the race after this.
Now, this may be a case study for something that I'm always fascinated with, the question of, is a primary a good thing for a party? Does it benefit the ultimate candidate by seasoning them, getting them ready for the race, or does it hurt them because they got to blow money here and they've taken a lot of fire, a lot of criticism along the way? And one side yes, one side no this time around, it looks like.
Yeah, I mean, I think you hear both things. I think most Democrats kind of want don't want to. Their ideal situation would be for Hillary to have a primary, but for it to be a kind of low-level one, like it is now. I mean, they want her to run, go through her paces, and then soundly defeat all of these people who are trying to run against her.
Okay, and I don't know if you want to give us any over-unders or predictions. Who do you think the next Republican will be to make the official announcement, maybe in the next week or two?
Oh, well, that's a good question. So we have Rubio on Monday. I don't know. I mean, I feel like your man up there in Wisconsin, once he gets back from, overseas, but I feel like his announcement can't be too far off.
All right, we'll be watching for that. David, thanks so much for joining us today.
I appreciate it.
That's David Friedlander, senior political correspondent with the Daily Beast, talking about Hillary Clinton's anticipated announcement of a presidential run on Sunday.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret.
In one measure of child well-being among rich nations, United States came in 26th in a list of 29 wealthy countries. It's a problem some doctors, policymakers, and community activists are trying to solve.
Our next guest is part of the movement to give kids a healthy start and move them towards better outcomes later in life.
Dr. Renee Boynton-Jarrett is a pediatrician at Boston Medical Center and associate professor at Boston University School of Medicine. She's also the founding director of the Vital Village Network in Boston and a featured expert in the upcoming PBS series on child wellness called Raising America. She's in the state this weekend for the Wisconsin World Cafe. Dr. Boynton-Jarrett, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, Renee, if you had to grade the United States on how well we're doing preparing children for positive health and later life outcomes, how would you say we're doing right now?
I would say we're underperforming, given our resources, our understanding of what it takes to really provide a solid foundation in early childhood that leads to many benefits and a great foundation for future life. I do believe that we could be doing so much more. We have all of the right skills, tools, and resources. It's how we're applying them.
Well, as a pediatrician, what are the biggest challenges that you see in child wellness in the country right now?
I think one of the biggest challenges that we're facing is the ability to effectively support families in putting together the most optimal resources for early childhood for their children. We know the first 3 years of life are a crucial period of time for brain development. They're a crucial period of time for laying the foundation for what would be positive health and developmental outcomes and future citizenship outcomes as well. And at this point in time, a lot of times families are really figuring out what the best thing to do is on their own. And without adequate support, they're getting a set of messages from the clinical environment and their pediatricians. They're getting a set of messages from early child care environment. They're getting separate messages from social services. And it's really important that we actually work together in a much more coordinated way to support families and make sure that every child, no child falls through the cracks.
Now, you mentioned those first 3 years as being crucial. What makes them so crucial?
It's the most heightened time of brain development. So the brain is actively developing over the first 3 years of life. The foundations of language, social-emotional regulation are developing. But also your primary attachment relationships with your caregivers are developing, and that really sets the tone for future relationships. So the first 3 years of life are a critical window where, enhancing the opportunities and resources and enrichment that children have during this early period has a huge payoff later on in life. We can do a lot of things across the life course that are beneficial to children. The value of them diminishes somewhat over time in comparison to this really critical window of early brain development and social-emotional development.
And if we miss the maximum potential of those first 3 years, what sorts of outcomes might we see down the road and on into adulthood?
Well, let's take, for example, attachment and forming a safe, secure bond with a primary caregiver. If a child fails to have that happen in, you know, the first 6 months of life, this has a very strong impact on future relationships. It has a very strong impact on the ways in which the child engages socially in the world. So it impacts language development, cognitive function. It impacts growth. And so it has a really long extension, potentially. And so although we can introduce resources later, we can try and form a secure attachment and base later, we can try and form additional set of relationships later, we don't get the same effect that we would have had making sure that that child had the best possible start.
Now, in the new upcoming PBS documentary series called Raising America, you echo a bit of what you said here, that we tend to think that parents are the number one factor in how well a child does, but it's a lot more complicated than that. You'd like to see a lot more coordination. What would that coordination look like to you?
I think that there are so many existing resources that operate almost completely separate. Like, we have a bunch of early childhood trains that move on different tracks. And so families can get lost. They can have a hard time putting it all together. And the responsibility for putting it all together is up to them. I think that we could have a coordinated set of investments that we believe all children should have access to, and that families have very easy access to establishing for their children. A lot of these things are things that are already in existence: high-quality childcare, access to wonderful child enrichment programs that help educate families as well as children, easy access to a stable medical home where a group of providers knows a family and a child and is watching them grow and develop over time. These are things that we already know are important and make a difference. These are things that are already set up. It's just that every child is not receiving them. So can we take a larger stand from a policy perspective, public health perspective, to really kind of tighten the web of resources to make it easier for every child to experience them?
You started an organization in Boston. It's called Vital Village. What kind of work do you do there?
Well, it's very similar to what we're discussing here. We're really creating a network of relationships and working relationships and collaborations with caregivers, as well as across multiple sectors for early childhood: education, health, legal advocacy, social service, community-based programs. And our goal is really to stay in optimal communication so that we can share best practices, so that we can enhance existing efforts and build upon them, so that we can bring existing best practices into spaces that need those supports and help. And we're finding that this working together in a more concerted, collective process, we're building a greater transparency. We're sharing an accountability for child health outcomes and child development and well-being outcomes. And we're really feeling as though we're building community capacity to do a better job in supporting child well-being.
And what kind of results and stories have you seen come out of that kind of approach at Vital Village?
We're still early on in the work, but there's tremendous motivation that's there. Some of our early success has really been the relationship between bringing caregivers, parents, and community members as equal partners at the table with community institutions such as schools and hospitals and legal advocate organizations. And what we found is that we all kind of could benefit from a shared set of tools to use to work together to make more optimal programs and have them grow and flourish and do what we all have in mind. We all share the same goal. We want to see kids thrive. We want to see families thrive and have strong set of protective factors. And we want to see communities flourish. And I think we are all pretty convinced that no agency owns responsibility for all of those things to happen on their own. No one sector kind of can do it all on their own, and we can't do it without collaboration with parents and community members. So what we've really seen success in early is that we can actually begin to work together in a much more coordinated fashion, that we can begin to break down silos, and that working together and committing to a shared learning space and collective goals, aligning our goals and sharing data is actually helping cultivate a larger ability to continue to do work together, to plan work together, to design work together, and to share an accountability for optimal outcomes for child well-being.
Dr. Boynton-Jarrett, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
Renee Boynton-Jarrett is a pediatrician at Boston Medical Center and associate professor at Boston University School of Medicine and the founding director of the Vital Village Network in Boston. She's a featured expert on the upcoming PBS documentary on child wellness called Raising America, and she's in the state this weekend for the Wisconsin World Cafe.
I'm Rob Ferrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrer.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Some recipes are just fundamental to the way we eat in America. Spaghetti and tomato sauce, chocolate cake, a side of broccoli. The thing is, what recipe do you choose among thousands?
Our next guest has made it a quest to scour the culinary world for what she calls genius recipes. Recipes that use maybe a new ingredient or a technique that make them game changers. She's been posting them on the blog Food 52, recipes that might become your new definitive take on things like chocolate cake, guacamole, roasted chicken, tomato sauce, you name it. The recipes come from food's big stars like Nigella Lawson and James Beard, but also from less obvious places.
Krista McGlory joins us now for this Food Friday. She's the executive editor of Food 52 and the author of Food 52, Genius Recipes, 100 Recipes That Will Change the Way You Cook. Krista, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, first of all, what makes a genius recipe?
That's a great question, and I get it a lot, because obviously there are lots of good recipes and great recipes out there, but there's sort of this upper echelon, I think, of recipes that will, once you make them once, they'll change the way you cook. You'll return to those recipes again and again. You may decide the technique is really wonderful and riff on it the next time. But whatever it is, it's very memorable and gives you a better way of doing something than you thought you always had to do.
And it isn't necessarily a more complicated or sophisticated recipe, right? It could be an easier way to do a thing in an awesome way.
Yes, it usually is easier, actually, in my experience. I mean, that's what's so surprising about a lot of the recipes in this book. So a really good example of that actually is the cover recipe, which is Marcella Hazan's tomato sauce. And, you know, a lot of times people think that to make their own spaghetti sauce, they have to chop an onion and chop garlic and all these herbs and simmer it for a really long time to get, you know, a true Sunday sauce. And her recipe just completely upended that. And all it is butter and an onion that you split in half and you don't even chop. And you simmer it with either fresh or canned tomatoes for 45 minutes. And you get something that tastes so much better than what would happen if you opened a jar. And dinner's ready in pretty much the same time once you've boiled your pasta and made your salad and, you know, gotten your bread out. Now tomato sauce can happen on a weeknight and you don't have to ever resort to buying a jar at the store again.
What is better about that particular recipe? I've been looking at it on the cover of your book all week. What makes that one better than a jar of something else?
It's such a true tomato flavor. It's very pure. And you'll get different results if you use fresh or canned tomatoes. The fresher ones that you get when they're really ripe in summer are going to be a little sweeter or just fresher tasting. And if you put that in the freezer in the wintertime, you'll be so happy to pull it out and have it on spaghetti sauce. So it will taste so much more like tomato and so fresh.
So, Kristen, I wonder if you had the light bulb moment. What was the first genius recipe that made you think of the concept of a genius recipe?
Well, I can't actually take credit for the entire concept. It sort of came out of conversations with the co-founders of Food 52, Amanda Hesser and Meryl Stubbs. And they had worked together for actually about 6 years on the Essential New York Times cookbook, and they had tested thousands of recipes together. And between what they had worked on and the work that we were doing at Food 52 testing a lot of recipes, we talked a lot about these exemplary recipes that, you know, people would talk about a lot and they would tell their friends about, and, you know, they would talk about at dinner parties and would get so excited to share with each other because they, you know, they had something so memorable about them, like the tomato sauce. The recipe that I started the column with was a strawberry sorbet from the River Cafe in London. And that is just three ingredients, and it's strawberries, lemon, and sugar. But what you do is you chop up the whole lemon and blend it in the food processor with the sugar, and then the strawberries. And the entire lemon goes in, and it's not too bitter, even though you leave the pith in. And it actually makes kind of a more refined and almost creamy strawberry sorbet by throwing the whole lemon in there. So lots of surprises, and it came out of a lot of conversations with Amanda and Meryl.
Well, I want to talk about a recipe that really just blew up, a recipe that Mark Bittman initially shared from Jim Leahy for no-knead bread. Now, everybody who's not a professional bread baker knows that bread can be finicky, and in general, it can be a lot of work, time-consuming. What's special about this one?
So this one, it really does, I mean, it says it right in the name. That's part of what was so, you know, what made this recipe travel so far, I think, is no-knead bread. And anyone who bakes bread knows that, you know, kneading isn't really, you know, kneading is kind of fun, actually. So, you know, if you enjoy that sort of thing, it's the only problem is I think it's intimidating to people because they don't know if they have done it enough. They don't know if they're using too much flour. They don't know when to stop. And this recipe took all of those questions out of the process. And I think Mark Bittman wrote, "Let time do the work." And that's exactly what this recipe does. You mix together the same ingredients that you normally would, yeast and flour and water and salt, and you just leave them to sit for 12 to 18 hours. And in that time, you know, the gluten develops and the yeast activates, and it basically kneads itself in a way. And then all you have to do is kind of flop it out of the bowl the next day and into a hot Dutch oven, and you have basically like artisanal style, you know, a country loaf that you've just made without having to know all that much about bread baking.
We've got that recipe linked at the Central Time Facebook page. It's Food Friday. We're talking with Kristen McGlory about her new book, Genius Recipes. These are recipes that once you try them, you'll never make that standard any other way a lot of the time. This is the way to do a lot of the basics. One of the ones that looked really good to me, Kristen, was a guacamole. And it's a different take than I have made guacamole, and I guess it's changed a lot of people's lives. What's different about this
Yes.
one?
it's so funny because you look at the ingredients and you don't think that you're like, okay, that's just guacamole like I've made 100 times before. Because it's, you know, onion and lime and chili and avocado, obviously, and cilantro. It's very simple. But the way that Roberto Santibanez, the author of this recipe, treats those ingredients completely changes the outcome. And what he does is he basically pummels the chili, onion, and salt together and some of the cilantro and makes sort of a dressing almost. He basically takes them from being crunchy to being a slurry. And you can either do it in a mortar and pestle or a molcajete or just with the side of a knife. They'll basically turn into a paste pretty readily. And then you mix the chopped up avocado in. But it's kind of almost more like an avocado salad that has this really intense, flavorful sauce that you're tossing it in. And you mush the avocado up just a little bit, just so it holds together. But you get these great creamy bites of avocado, too. So it's kind of like reversing what we're used to having with a guacamole that's the avocado has turned to mush and there's all these crunchy bits in it. And it both makes the texture better and also makes those flavors kind of travel further, too, I think.
That one was interesting to me because I sort of think of a lot of lime juice as being the secret to good guacamole, but you don't really miss it.
Well, it's included optionally, which, I mean, I always do because I agree. I think it really helps brighten up all the flavors, but you don't have to.
So when people try some of these recipes, and I'm sure you've tested them on other humans, do they say, okay, yeah, this is it. I'm never going back to the way I had done it before?
Yes. I mean, and in most every case, I would say so. In fact, with the guacamole, the editor of the cookbook, Ali Slagle, said that, you know, she was being very diligent and trying a lot of recipes as she was reading my write-ups about them. And she said she made that guacamole 6 times in a week, which is borderline obsessive. But yeah, everyone who tries it, I think, tends to agree that it's hard to go back to any other way of making guacamole after you make it this way.
I think that's in my forecast for tonight, now that we're talking about it. Yeah, guacamole. Well, I want to talk about one of my favorite desserts. I'm a strawberry shortcake addict in almost any form, and you say that you have the genius recipe for strawberry shortcake, and it's got a surprise ingredient, because sometimes, I guess, mm-hmm. the biscuits get a little crumbly. What happens mm-hmm. with this one?
So for this one, which actually I discovered in sort of a fun way, a lot of these recipes, most of them came from tips from the Food 52 community or from other, you know, writers or editors in the food world. And this one was actually something that Melissa Clark had Instagrammed from the James Beard Awards because they were serving it. And she said secret ingredient for James Beard's mother's shortcakes is hard-cooked egg yolk. So, of course, I had to go look into this. And it's true. It's you hard-cook an egg and then push the yolk through a sieve, and that kind of blends into the flour. And the difference is, you know, there are other shortcake recipes where you would use an egg yolk to give richness and kind of bind it together, but they can end up a little bit tough because of the extra moisture that the egg yolk is adding. It can add more gluten and toughen up the flour. So by hard cooking it, it takes out some of the moisture but still adds in that richness and makes it very tender. So it ended up being one of the more popular recipes in the column, I would say.
We're talking with Kristen McGlory right now on Food Friday. She's the executive editor of Food 52 and the author of Food 52 Genius Recipes, 100 recipes that will change the way you cook.
And we want to hear from you on this. Do you have any genius recipes up your sleeve? Any secret ingredients that have changed your cooking repertoire that you want to pass on and share on the air today? Questions about the recipes maybe that we've been talking about, too. You can call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up the conversation after a look at the news with Kristen Durst. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're talking about genius recipes, definitive versions of key recipes that might use a special ingredient or a new technique. Kristen McGlory is with us now. She's the executive editor of Food 52 and the author of Food 52 Genius Recipes, 100 recipes that will change the way you cook.
And now we ask you, Food Friday listener, to reveal your secrets. Do you have any genius recipe up your sleeve? A secret ingredient that makes something awesomer, or a technique, something that saves time, makes the food better? Maybe a question about something we've talked about so far today? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll go to our caller now. We've got Ken on the line in Fort Atkinson. Hi, Ken.
I believe it's actually supposed to be Tim.
Tim, okay. A little bit of distortion maybe on your name, but welcome, Tim. What do you got for
Hello.
Us?
A blueberry bacon cheeseburger.
All right.
Wow.
A lot of people will have said you did this recipe, and I personally have made it for a few friends, and all of them have loved it. But I make a half-pound burger, and I usually put a couple pieces of cheese on it. I like my burgers a little more spicy, so I usually use, like, jalapeno cheddar. And then I'll end up frying the bacon and everything else. And I toast a blueberry bagel. Now, you can either buy a store-bought blueberry bagel, or if you make them at home, you mix in your blueberries with the batter and you fry it up. Or bake it. I've seen some people bake it. I don't think it tastes quite as good, but some people do it. And I put cream cheese on one side of the toasted bagel, and I personally put my own other condiments on the other side, and you just put it together. So the bagel is actually replacing your bun.
Wow.
You kind of blew my mind with that one. I'm almost speechless. What do you think about that combination, Kristen? Blueberry, bacon, jalapeno burger.
It sounds pretty fantastic, I have to say.
What do you think would work about it?
Well, you know, we actually have a sort of similar concept, something on the Food 52 website called the New England Burger. And that has, I believe, grilled apple slices on it and bacon and cheese. And it's kind of all these New England ingredients all put together. And then you serve it with blueberry beer. So, it was one of those things that we tried it at first and thought, oh, this probably is going to be a little bit weird, but we might as well. And then we ended up all really loving it. So I can see the appeal of this one, too.
All right.
Well, and I think cream cheese kind of secretly, like, makes everything better, too.
I agree with that one. Well, Tim, thank you for that. And you can join us, too, with your call, your secret ingredient, your genius recipe at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234.
And, Kristen, I want to get into another recipe that we've got up at the Central Time Facebook page. You know, fried chicken, a standard of American weekend meal for sure. You've got rosemary brined buttermilk fried chicken. So what's the key? What makes this fried chicken different and genius?
Well, there are a few things. This one's from Michael Rollman, and he did a lot of fried chicken recipe testing and just kind of stumbled on a fairly perfect technique. The brine has rosemary and onion and garlic in it and some lemon juice, I believe. And then so that kind of helps keep the meat really, really juicy and flavorful. And then the seasoned coating has like paprika and some cayenne, I believe, and it's buttermilk coating, and there's baking powder in it too, so it gives it a lot of lift. And just his technique and his perfection here is what makes this so good. But another thing that's really great about it is that you can make it ahead and leave it, which is just huge when you're frying chicken for a crowd. You don't want to be doing it right before they show up. So basically, he just makes it a few hours ahead and then puts it in a low oven, and it actually gets crispier. And so then you can kind of, you know, clean your kitchen actually and wash up and still have really great fried chicken to serve. And it's so flavorful because, you know, sometimes you just want to eat the crunchy skin. But here, because of the brine, everything, the whole thing just tastes amazing.
Great. Well, that one is also up on the Central Time Facebook page. And maybe you could serve with it another recipe here. Broccoli cooked forever. I'm thinking broccoli mush, but this is in your Genius Recipes collection. How does that mm-hmm. work?
I know. That one has the best name. It just, you know, it grabs people's attention pretty immediately. It almost sounds like a dare. And it's because we're, you know, especially for people who have kind of, you know, bad flashbacks to the school cafeteria overcooked broccoli. And, you know, it was kind of flavorless and mushy and kind of like a weird color. This one, it is cooked for a very long time. It's cooked for 2 hours, but it's cooked in olive oil and garlic and anchovy. And it's kind of like slow simmered in this combination of things. And it turns it into something else entirely. It's almost more like a condiment by the end. And it just brings out, because you're cooking it gently forever instead of overcooking it at, you know, a high heat, if you were steaming it or something like that, it just kind of brings out all this sweetness in the broccoli, and it absorbs all those flavors that it's simmering in. So I recommend that one.
It's Food Friday. We're getting genius recipes from Kristen McGlory and taking your standbys too, the genius inspirations you've come up with. I will go back to our callers with Randy in Sauk County. Randy, hi.
Yeah, hi. I had a series of health problems about 25 years ago that required me to change my diet, and I couldn't just go backwards. So I had to develop stuff that I could use, you know, forever. And my wife said to me, "You take responsibility for your diet." So I did. And I came up with things like tuna steak and apricots and jalapenos, say, together in a saucepan simmered. And you wouldn't think of apricots together with tuna steak and jalapenos, but I just in desperation to come up with something that was very high protein, very low in fat, and a little olive oil in there to be incredibly nutritious, but something I could actually eat and sustain. Things like that I could have is turned out to be so good, and I've got dozens of them. Also, I can take it on a holiday, pre-made in a pan, and put it on the stove, and then everybody can have their turkey and gravy, and I can have that.
That tuna. Randy, thank you so much. Well, necessity is the mother of invention. Kristen, do people, I don't know how the pros work. Do they just take, I'm going to try these three ingredients together, see if they pop, like, I don't know, tuna, jalapeno, and apricot in this instance.
Sure, but I agree that necessity is the mother of invention, too. And I mean, I think a lot of these recipes, they come from people who've been cooking for a very long time, and maybe they just got tired of the way that they had always done something, or maybe they just made a mistake one time and realized, oh, that actually works better. I think in the case of these recipes in this book, they come from people who can recognize when something is a better way of doing something. And same thing with this tuna and apricots. Like, you know, there are other ways that you could go for having a healthy meal, but if you stumble on something that has so much flavor, I mean, tuna is such a you know, flavorful cut of fish, and then it needs something bold to stand up to it. So, you know, once you start to cook a little bit more and experiment, then you get the confidence to try things that might seem a little bit outlandish, but you just have an inkling that they just might work.
So, Kristen, just briefly, there's a sweet recipe in here in which a sweet potato turns into sort of a caramel sauce. Tell us about that one.
Yeah, I love that one. It's only one ingredient, which which is so fun. There are a few one-ingredient recipes in this book. And this one is a caramel that's made with just sweet potatoes. So the sweet potatoes are sort of steamed in the oven, and then you take the cover off, and they sort of like caramelize and stick to the bottom a little bit. And then you squeeze out all of the liquid that has come from cooking them and cook that down, and it becomes a caramel just because there's natural sugars in there. And it has a lot more flavor than a caramel that you make with sugar. It has kind of like an earthy, you know, the flavor of sweet potatoes distilled into a very sweet little package.
Well, that is genius. Kristen, thank you so much for joining us today.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
That's Kristen McGlory, executive editor of Food 52, author of Food 52 Genius Recipes, 100 recipes that'll change the way you cook. You can find two of them on the Central Time Facebook page. A big comedic milestone today, an anniversary for fans of Monty Python. This week marks the 40th anniversary of the movie Monty Python and the Holy Grail.
It started as a small budget gamble, $400,000, in fact. It became a cult classic and, of course, a way for people to annoy each other by quoting the endless amazing lines from that movie.
Lines like, it's just a flesh wound, and there are some who call me Tim.
Or the knights who say me, and I'm not dead yet.
We could go on, obviously, annoyingly, as long as we wanted. Interesting fact, I had just learned this today. Most of the money for the movie came from rock stars, members of the bands Pink Floyd and Genesis, for example. I did not know that. Well, here's a clip from the movie Sir Bedivere talking to an angry mob.
What makes you think she's a witch?
Well, she turned me into a newt.
A newt?
I got better.
Burn already!
Happy 40th to Monty Python and the Holy Grail, and we go to the news with the intermission music from the movie.
Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio, then we'll review the biggest headlines from around the state this week in our Wisconsin News Roundup. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. News is coming up next on Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thank you.